The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to the Sisters in Loss podcast, a faith-based podcast that spotlights Black women who replace silence with storytelling around pregnancy and infant loss and infertility. Black women experience miscarriage and stillbirth 4 to 5 times more likely than white women, according to the NIH and CDC. Whether you've experienced a miscarriage, infant loss, stillbirth, are trying to conceive, or have an infertility diagnosis, you will learn about resources and strategies to heal, gain clarity, peace, hope, and find an empowering path forward after loss. I'm your host, Erica M. McAfee, and you will hear me interview sisters in loss who have healed from such a painful and traumatic experience by sharing their testimonies and stories to inspire and help others turn their pain into their purpose. Now let's get started. Welcome to episode 215 of the Sisters in Loss podcast. Fertility is not just a birthing factor. Sometimes it's male factor. Male factor infertility can be caused by low sperm production, abnormal sperm function, or blockages that prevent the delivery of sperm. Illnesses, injuries, chronic health problems, lifestyle choices, and many other factors may contribute to male factor infertility. Today's guest shares her story with male factor infertility going through intrauterine insemination, or IUI, which resulted in a miscarriage and having her rainbow baby. She knew her partner had a high probability of infertility due to their medical history. They started trying naturally and were unsuccessful, so they went to a fertility specialist. Then they were formally diagnosed with male factor infertility with a less than 5% chance of having natural children. They then moved to a third-party reproduction clinic and decided on using donor sperm. They were successful with their medicated IUI that resulted in their first child. And when they tried for their second child with a medicated IUI, was successful, but it resulted in a miscarriage at 11 weeks gestation. In this episode, we discuss male factor infertility, how to find donor sperm for Black and Brown people, and recovery and healing from miscarriage. This episode is for you to listen to if you and your partner have been diagnosed with male factor infertility or are considering searching for donor sperm for people of color. Listen to our guest today. Well, welcome, Anonymous, to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So this episode, we're not sharing, obviously, her name because of privacy concerns, but I want to make sure that her story is told, obviously from a perspective of healing, of grieving, but from a perspective of fertility challenges as a couple. So I would love for you to, obviously, I'm not going to give any history of where you're from and what you do, but because we're going to keep it anonymous, but I would love for you to really just take us back on your journey to motherhood and share with us your lost story and infertility journey.
Thank you so much, Erica. Let me just say first that this podcast, Sisters in Loss, has been a tremendous support for me. And as my partner and I have gone through loss, and it's such an isolating experience. So to have this recently has been a balm for the soul. So thank you. I would have to start back to when my husband and I were dating. I knew he wanted to be a father. Like most couples in relationships. I did a little bit of prying on him. He had a on his notes app on his phone. I found one day a list of baby names when we were dating, and I knew that it was the date on the list was before we had even met. So I knew becoming a father was something very important to him. As we got more serious and decided to commit to each other further, my partner sat me down one day and wanted to discuss something very serious, he said. And I knew I could tell because he was visibly upset. And he opened up to me and said that infertility affected his family from his father's side. And he basically said that, you know, if we want children, which he did, it would take a lot for that to happen. And we would have to definitely pursue infertility treatments for the reality of becoming parents to be true. And I grew up in a low resource environment, I should say, and I didn't really have, my parents are divorced. I didn't have a lot of good examples of relationships around me. So I always grew up saying I didn't want kids. And I really fervently believed that. Until I fell in love with my partner, and I, especially knowing that in that moment, moments leading up to it, fatherhood was so important to him. It was something that I really wanted to make happen for us because I knew he really wanted to become a father. And also falling in love with someone can change your perspective on things. And so it wasn't an issue for me. My partner was very, he was concerned when he said that to me that I was going to leave him. Because of the challenge, or he said, nobody wants to be with somebody who can't make something so naturally happen. And I thought he was kind of crazy. I said, what is wrong with you? I love you. I would never leave you for your potential inability to have children. And he felt, it was like seeing a relief on his, like visibly and in his shoulders, just a relax that he finally told me this challenge that we may face and that it wasn't going to be an impediment on our relationship. So fast forward towards our marriage, we decided, like most couples, to start trying naturally before we got married. So we started 6 months before. We're like, maybe, you know, let's just try it. So we got through like a year of trying naturally, nothing happened. Then we're like, let's get a little bit more serious about this. And we decided to go to our local fertility clinic and get screened. Both of us, we started doing a workup for me. I think it's actually interesting that they always go to, it was the female first before we even considered my partner, even though we knew my husband had a potential infertility diagnosis. But my workup came back fine. And then my husband came up where he was given the diagnosis of azoospermia. We weren't necessarily prepared for that diagnosis, but we knew the issue on his family side was a genetic issue that from his father's side of the family, his brother had the same diagnosis. And it was, I will say it was devastating, but then our clinic gave us an option of doing a testicular mapping to see if there was any sperm. So azoospermia itself means absence of sperm. I will say, yes, that just hearing that was devastating, but we immediately got some hope hearing that we could have this testicular mapping done. Now, hearing about the procedure sounded excruciatingly painful to me. I spoke with my partner about it and I said, do you really want to do this? They literally put like dots on the testicle, on each testicle, and then physically go in. And it just seemed like the most excruciating, painful thing to go through. And he said, you know, if I can't be a father, I don't want to leave any doubts to a biological father, like of our child. I don't want to leave any for, you know, I wish I would have tried it. So we did the testicular mapping, and then we went through with the procedure. And I will say it really, seeing your partner, you know, in surgical, in a hospital gown, getting ready for surgery, someone that you really love, like he was very vulnerable, and it really got to me that this is going to be our reality. If we wanted to go down this road, we had to get really familiar with this kind of a sterile, you know, hospital setup to become parents. And So we went on with the procedure. And about 2 weeks later, a doctor called us in to his office to talk to us. And he said to us that we had a less than 5% chance of conceiving naturally. And his suggestion was that we should move on to third-party reproduction. Now, I didn't even know what that was, I'll be honest. And he wrote down, you know, here are some options for you. Number one, you just don't have your own biological children. Number two, you can pursue adoption. Number three, you can pursue embryo adoption, which is a donor egg and donor sperm already ready to go. Do the IVF route. Next option and final option is you can use donor sperm. I'll say that the hearing this and going through this meeting kind of like time just kind of stopped. I saw the disappointment and devastation on my partner's face, which again was just really hard to witness because our society puts so much on masculinity for men. And also I will say it was devastating because this is something that is my husband had no control over. It's a genetic issue on his family side. He wasn't able to, he had no control over it. So, you know, to be there understanding and then hearing these options, we went home that, I know, I think from that appointment, we actually went and stopped at a bar because he's like, I want a drink. I just want a drink and just to calm down from, you know, what we've heard. Sat at a bar, at a dive bar and had a drink together. And then when we got home, my husband immediately went to the bedroom and shut the door. And he was there for probably a little over 20, maybe 24 hours, maybe a day. And you know, dark out, dreary, rainy. And I was sitting in our living room and I was physically upset myself because I knew he was going through the grieving process of recognizing that we weren't probably able to have biological children together. And it's something that I don't think you really understand it until you go through it, loss is like. And at that time, we were married and we were not sure, like I wasn't sure what was going to happen with our relationship because of how upset he was. And I think he felt, after he told me, actually, he felt similarly that it was just like a turning point for like deciding some life decisions in such a short time period. So we decided we're just going to like stop with fertility stuff for a while, take a break from it, get self, spend time together, enjoying each other's company, get him to like enjoy things, find joy in things again. See, it was his grieving process. So saw him experiencing joy in certain things we would do or hanging out with friends and spending quality time together. Walking or doing some active things, running together, which we enjoyed. Some joy started to creep back in. And then we had heard from the local Resolve support group, which Resolve is the national infertility organization. And we joined that organization. They had a monthly support group, get that support we needed to hear from other couples. For me, it was really important because, you know, when you get this kind of a diagnosis, sometimes it just feels as though you're the only one in the room, or you're the only one. It's like a spot on you in society, like that people don't necessarily know because it's unseen, but you feel like it. And so having a Resolve support group was just really crucial for us to talk to other couples going through infertility. So we went there the following month, and there was a discussion about this third party reproduction. We started to do some research, and I remember when we came home, my partner, let's go to the sperm bank. It's not here often, but we decided to take a tour just to see like what our local sperm bank, like what options they had, just to learn about what the process would be, logistics of like cost, and then just to see if they could connect us with other couples that had used sperm donation to become parents. And so we did that. And I want to say it was a very pleasant visit. There was nothing uncomfortable about it. We got a really quick history of sperm donation. And I remember the clinic representative saying that, you know, the laws for sperm donation are really like at least 20 years ahead of egg donation, and that it's becoming very common. Right now, where donation is very popular for single women, LGBTQ couples, that there are so many options out there for family building. So we took the information we had, and then a few days after that visit, my husband was like, let's just go for it. I'd like to do this, and I want us to try it, see if it works. And I said, well, first step would be, we got to pick on our, how we're going to do that. There was a digital one, and then there was a physical one that we had. And then the donor representative said that, bank representative said that they did like a photo matching. So if you send in a childhood photo of your partner, they could choose someone who looked similar. And so what we did is my partner picked out three of the top donors he liked. So you get profiles, you're given, like there's a basic essay that each donor has written. There's information, history, family history, testing. So we both went our separate ways to like, you know, get your top three, I'll get my top three, and talk about it. And then we'll also use the information that the clinic gets us with the photo matching. And for me, the biggest, you know, factor was I didn't want to choose a donor that, mind, I understand a lot of donors, sperm donors do what they do for money. And I didn't want someone whose sole reason for donating was, my partner wanted someone, he was really important to him, someone that had the same features that he did. So the photo matching, I think for him was really crucial. For myself, once we together and then got all the information, it turns out that we had the same donor as in our top three. Then we discussed that donor, the same donor that the representative gave to us was my number one and also my husband's number one. And we were shocked. I was shocked at that. I was like, okay, this could be something that we're on to. Let's discuss further. And what really, you know, got me to the donor that we used was their essay. Just brought tears to my eyes. The donor said that, you know, they were recently able to become a parent themselves, and they were in a center that my husband and I worked in, and they wanted to donate to give another family the opportunity to build their family because they know how much joy it can bring in the lives of a couple. So it was just a beautiful profile, and we felt comfortable, but we also realized that we need to talk to other couples that had used third-party reproduction, whether it be egg donor or sperm donor, to kind of see down the road, like, what are some of the issues we might be facing, and societal issues, familial issues, like, what were our concerns? And two or three couples, and I think that was very, very helpful for us because we got to understand the unique challenges of raising a donor-conceived child, and they're equipped to be prepared for certain circumstances. Now, the first one that we thought about was, what about the issues of privacy and of your child being taken away from you? One was quickly answered by the clinic representative saying, you know, we legally sign a paper when we purchase the vials of sperm that indicate that we own essentially the sperm, and there's no, we, you know, any children that are conceived out of the vials that we purchased are ours and cannot be taken from us legally. We were also suggested to join the donor sibling network, which is it's the largest registry in the US where you register any birth of the children from the vials that you have purchased, and it can connect, it connects donor conceived children to their donor relative, their donor siblings across the country. Now, we chose an open donor. So there's open and closed. Open donors, when they're 18, they can contact their parent if they choose. And then closed donors are donors that do not want to be contacted at all. So it's in their file that please don't contact them. And there's legislation around sperm donation federally. I think that, you know, you only hear the scary stories, I guess I would say, in the news where, you know, 150 children, donor children have been conceived. Those are circumstances that are very rare. And I think that's important to share because so much isn't about third-party reproduction from a society perspective, and there's already a stigma on choosing this option. But in time, it is an option that is gaining popularity in the country, and it's important to understand that, you know, it could be a stigma that your child would be aware of. Now, when I say that, I also go into the second factor for my partner and I, what we considered, and that was the fact that, you know, parents who have donor-conceived children choose not to tell them that they are donors. All that we were encouraged to read, all of the other couples we discussed strongly encourage us not to do that because it creates a secret in the family. It creates a separation. And also most donor-conceived children know that they're donor-conceived, something about their family, they have a fling, and we didn't want to create any that in our household. So our fertility clinic had a counselor that if we proceed with having a donor-conceived child, that they encouraged a session that we've, and this was some of the questions we came equipped with, like, how do we tell our child, you know, tell a baby they're donor-conceived? They're not going to understand that. So the recommendations we were got is, this is a part of our child's story that we tell them from birth. You know, this is the story of everyone. You know, you have a birth story. And so we have a story that we wrote ourselves that shares our journey to getting to that point that we would share with our child over and over. And obviously as a baby, we're not going to share the explicit details, but we have like a basic line that we say, you know, first of all, you know, we love you very much and very badly, we wanted to have you and we just needed help. So we had a help from doctors, from a very nice person who helps have you. And we were really fortunate that we were able to have you because of this. Now, that's the story that we share as our child is smaller. As the child grows up, you can fill in more explicit details. And there's also tons of books out there on third-party reproduction that helps to explain third reproduction to children based on what age range they are. In third, we decided... because the nature of my husband's male factor infertility, his family knew what we shared with them, what our decision making was, and they were supportive of our choice to use donor sperm. And I think that's another factor that some couples have to face, is like, who do you tell in your family? Who knows? Because the worst fear that you have as a parent, you know, you want to protect your child, and children aren't, you know, younger children don't know the explicit details. Like I said, we share a version of it age appropriate for the child. But as they get older, you know, depending on who you tell in your family, you want to make sure that, you know, the information, when they get to the age of understanding more and more, this information is coming from you. There was a fear on our side of like, whoever knows may say something and then our child will be confused or upset. And we talk to them. We proceeded forward knowing it may be an issue. And we did a medicated IUI, which is an insemination. So we had purchased our vials. We went through fertility medicine called Femara and did an ovulation trigger, and then had to go in for an ultrasound to check my follicles. Once we finished that and were given the okay, we proceeded with our IUI. And we really lucky through the medicated IUI that we were successful the first time around. We had a full pregnancy and were able to have a very healthy child. And I will say that process of having gone through the hardship of the diagnosis and the procedures and the decision-making, like getting to the point where we were pregnant and then going through a pregnancy, it was the first time we felt normal, like a normal that hasn't experienced infertility, though we know 1 in 7 couples do. And that was like, wow, we can take a little breather now. After we finished after our child was born, we had purchased enough vials of sperm because we knew we wanted to have a donor sibling. And I felt that was important for our child to have someone immediately related to them that they could relate to. And that I just felt it would be the greatest source for them to have that person there. So, but we waited. So between our first infertility treatment and then the next one, there's a 4-year. And so we recently started it about last October to try again for our donor conceal number 2. I will say that between that time, we also were now a resource for other couples who were considering production. So we've participated in support groups, other Resolve groups, other third-party groups that have popped up in the scene. And I think that I'm seeing more and more of these groups. So I know that more and more couples are choosing these options or considering it at least. So the fact that we're able to be a resource to other couples, I think, is important. And also, we continue counseling. So we've had marriage counseling. We've also, my partner has had one-on-ones with other father of donor-conceived children, where he's been able to talk and share some of his fears and anxiety about it. And I had as well, where I chat with folks also going through this. It's hard. And one thing we learned in our counseling session was that, third-party reproduction isn't just a decision you make and it's over, decision, but there's always going to be like a secret third person, we call it in our family, in our relationship, rather, the secret third person, because of our child's donor conceived status. And every now and again, we have to address that if it comes up, if we have a new concern that shows up, we need to be able to talk to it. And I think that's important for couples considering this, to know that it's just not a one and done thing, that you're going to have to consider down the line issues that may come up. So with our second child having started October, we're really ready to go. We did another medicated IUI. We were very fortunate to have conceived again on the first medicated IUI. And our fertility clinic transferred us over to our midwifery care at about 7 weeks. So I had unfortunately, because of COVID restrictions, my partner wasn't able to be in the room for any of the treatments this time around, which was really and even more isolating almost. But we were able to ultrasound before being transferred, and my husband was in the car. I had like a selfie stick. We saw the heartbeat of the baby, no concerns at the time. And then to be transferred. And we were successful very fast the second time around. My apprehension of starting again with infertility treatments was it's like a mental block, and you know what the finish line is, but you don't know, you're in this marathon, you don't know where the mile marker is, but you know where you want to get to, but you don't know how long it's going to take. So it's also this like mental mind game of how much can I like checking in with myself all the time. How am I feeling? What am I doing? How's my anxiety? And constantly having to do that throughout this infertility process, which can be very stressful for both partners. When it comes to the hormones of it, it can also be even more stressful. The physical changes of it, whether it be like irritability or, having the worst acne since high school, physical and a long-term process when you're going through a mental process to go through back through fertility treatments. But we felt we were ready. So, and we were really grateful to be successful. When we transferred, we had our first prenatal appointment at 10 weeks or at 9 weeks, and we decided to opt for the non-invasive prenatal testing this time around. We did not do that the first time. We had an ultrasound, our midwife had like one that you could hook up to her iPhone. So we did an ultrasound. We couldn't hear the heartbeat, but she wasn't worried because we were 9 weeks. She's like, come back next week, we'll check it. Make sure you're feeling okay. I will say between that time, it was between that appointment and the next appointment, I started feeling of being pregnant, but I didn't think much of it because I had not been through us before. So I didn't know, be alarmed, but I definitely noticed a loss of sensation and like breastfeeding, lack of cravings in that time, but I hadn't thought much of it. After the first prenatal appointment, it was a Wednesday, and I was in a work Zoom call, and I felt like some dull pain in my lower back, which wasn't on normal because I had had that before. Getting worse. I turned my camera off from my work call, and after the call, I felt like sensation of fluid. So I went to the bathroom and I saw like really dark, dry, blood just drops. And I feel like I remember saying in the moment, oh no, no, like this isn't, something's wrong. We called the midwife said, and this was like 4:30, 5:30 in the afternoon. She said, you know, could be nuts coming tomorrow morning. We'll check the heartbeat of the baby and, you know, just let me know if anything changes, but you should be okay. So I didn't think anything. My partner and I didn't think, we're like, okay, so, you know, this is maybe normal, but we'll just go in and check tomorrow. About 3 hours later, I had a sharp pain and then ran to the bathroom and saw the dark red blood. And we called the midwife, but I knew before she said anything, I knew what she was going to say. And she basically, and I'm grateful for this, she said to us, you know, I believe you're having a miscarriage. You're going to experience a loss. And I want you to take a moment to stop and just live in this experience, this moment. Stay on the phone with me. There's no one can prepare for a miscarriage, but I believe that this is going to happen. And then we took that pause and my partner held me as I started to weep in his arms. And it felt unbelievable in the moment because, you know, not so long ago we were saying, oh, we'll just go in and everything's going to be fine. And after all we had been through to get to where we were, it felt like evil had dropped on us. She pressed the midwife to walk us through like what she thought was going to be, what she said, you know, you're going to peak, you're going to lose more and more blood, passing clots, and you will peak. And then, we had our next prenatal visit the next day. So she's like, well, just keep that visit. Come on in. It was at 10:30 in the morning. I get our daughter ready for bed. It was really hard because I was teary and my partner was upset and I didn't want her to, I'm sure she felt something was up, but I didn't want her to notice it and say something. So we tried really hard. We got her ready for bed. Luckily, she went down to bed very easily. No one knew in our family that we were pregnant. We were trying purposely to not tell anyone because being donor conceived and having our family know, pregnant last time, exactly when. That's one benefit of fertility treatments is that you are able to track so closely that you know the moment you're pregnant. And this time around, so we were hoping to surprise everyone. We were close to 12 weeks, so we were very eager to do that. And we hadn't even told our child we were going to sit her down when we made it to 12 weeks to explain to her. So putting her to bed, knowing that we wouldn't have that moment in the following days to share with her was hard to get through. But I will say that my body started to take over after getting her down. It was a very traumatic experience for me, going through the miscarriage. I will say that even though our midwife explained it to me, I did not understand. I mean, my body kind of went into, if counselor now tells me is that my body basically shut down, like my thinking shut down. It's like your body goes through trauma. You have that fight or flight response. And I was frozen in time. Everything seemed to slow down. And I was just shocked. I didn't experience it to be so, and I'll be a little bit more explicit. It was so bloody. And I would have a sharp pain, like a contraction, and that would be followed by clotting, blood loss. And sometimes it wasn't very, it wouldn't pass easily. So it's hanging from me. And that was a traumatic experience for me. I'm very open with my body and in tune with my body typically. But to see that happening was very hard for me. And my partner holding me, I'm crying, you know, sitting, going through this in the bathroom all night long. It was like 2 to 3 times an hour for the entire night. Come the morning, I basically kind of closed myself in the bathroom, and my partner got my daughter to daycare, our daughter to daycare. And when we, I felt very weak. I didn't feel, obviously we had been up all night, so super tired, dehydrated a little bit. I felt devastated, you know, there's nothing else to explain or to describe like what the feeling of loss is. You feel empty. But what I did notice is that the pain hadn't stopped, and the blood clotting had not stopped. And our midwife had indicated that it should have stopped. So when we got to our 10:30 appointment, she did another handheld ultrasound. And she said to us that it looked like there was some tissue left in there. And she wasn't sure if it was stuck there or if it was going to pass naturally. So she suggested we go on to the ER. Before we left the midwife clinic, she shared with us that our non-invasive prenatal testing had come back, and that our baby had a marker for chromosomal abnormality, which is the most common cause of miscarriage, I learned, 21, which is Down syndrome. So she had reassured us that, you know, this a miscarriage oftentimes is the body's way of taking care of, is nature's way of taking care of a pregnancy that may not have sustained itself, that it was nothing with my body, that I should not feel as though, you know, I wasn't equipped to hold to maintain this pregnancy, but that it just happens. And it's our, again, the body's natural way of handling a pregnancy that may not have lasted. So we went on to the emergency room knowing that. And again, COVID and the emergency room was a wild experience. First of all, my partner had dropped me off at the front door, and here I'm still bleeding, very, very weak, not feeling well. Immediately, one of the benefits is, given where I was, I got back and to the ER immediately. Once we got back to the ER, IV put in, an ultrasound technician came, and they transferred me to another room. The technician came to take the ultrasound. They did allow my partner to come in then at that time. I was still in very deep pain, and before they did the ultrasound, they did a pelvic exam. Now, I should preface this to say that I'm terrified of hospitals. Our country does not have a good, and our medical sector in this country does not have a good track record with Black women in the hospital. So I felt a lot of anxiety going to the hospital. I had these fears of people touching me or people not treating me, just because of my past experience with doctors not trusting when I say I'm in pain. I am really in pain. This is why also I would say my partner and I opted for midwifery care with our first pregnancy, because I felt much more comfortable in the care of people that I had a long-term relationship with and that would respect my wishes. And so being in the hospital, still going through the miscarriage after, it was well after 17 hours, was just, it really added more stress to our situation. When the pelvic exam was being performed, I could feel I was losing blood. They were trying to stop the blood loss and to figure out what was going on. The doctor who was doing the pelvic exam said that, you know, she was pretty sure there was some placental tissue that was retained. And she wasn't sure, she needed to see an ultrasound. So they did an ultrasound after that pelvic exam. She also took some tissue for pathology during that. I believe some of the clots that were coming out. And the ultrasound technician came. It was excruciatingly painful. It's akin to how after birth, when the placenta detaches, there's like a pain in the abdomen. That was the worst pain I had experienced, because they had to get a really detailed ultrasound picture just to see what was going on at the time. And they did the pain meds until after, which was not what we'd either, but as it started to feel a little bit more comfortable, the doctor came back, and this is over the course of, let's say, like 3 or 4 hours. We were fortunate that my in-laws were able to get our daughter from daycare, so we didn't have to worry. And we did have to tell them at that time that I was in the hospital. And that was a bit devastating because this was the first time we had to tell someone that we were pregnant, but we had lost our child. After an hour or so, basically said, we think that you're having an incomplete miscarriage. And our recommendations are you can either take misoprostol, go home, let this finish itself naturally. But our strong recommendation for you is to do a dilation and curettage, because that there's just no retained tissue. Mentioned that for folks going through infertility treatments, it's a DNC is more preferable because then you can start again as soon as the year comes after, you can start again. So based off of our options, we decided to go with the DNC. Because I was still in the ER, they told me and my partner that he had to leave. And I could see his face was upset. I didn't want him to leave me because, again, I have extreme anxiety in the hospital and they're telling me I'm going to the OR and I have to stay a night and he can't be with me. And so that was really hard for me to hear, for him to hear. We have him being my advocate, we've talked and trained for him to be my healthcare advocate. So not having someone there was really scary to think about, but we wanted to proceed. Making sure that there was nothing, no infection, possibility of an infection, to make sure we had the placental tissue removed. Once I got up to OR, I remember there was a nursing shift. There was a delay to get me in the OR. And then a second nurse that came on staff, she was the night nurse. She was a woman of color and she had a BLM pin on her lapel. And I don't know why. I felt immediately a lot better. She came in, she looked me in the face, looked me in the eyes. How are you doing? What can I do? You know, I'm here to help you and support you. And I felt for the first time since I had gotten to the ER that I could breathe, that somebody, I trusted someone. So that really, I don't know if that was intentional or if it was just wasn't planned, but it gave an enormous comfort to me knowing that my nurse was a woman of color and also was an advocate. So my rolling to the ER went fine. To the OR. I've only had anesthesia for dental issues in the past. So it was kind of weird being stretched into the, you know, go to the OR. You're kind of up and down to the OR bed. The doctor was very kind. The OBGYN came in and explained what we're doing and how it would be very straightforward. And she said, I'm going to call your husband right away after and let him know how things go. And so you know that we are contacting your family. I woke up a few hours later. At that point, it was like 9:45. And the nurse, my lovely nurse, said, you know, you have to do three things to be able to go home. You have to be able to urinate, you have to eat something, and you have to be able to walk. And since I did not like hospitals, I was definitely like, I'm going to get out of here tonight. And she also, once I did those three things, she goes, well, now you need to talk to my charge nurse, because my supervisor, because they're not going to let you go because it's late. And I live maybe 10 miles from the hospital and I knew I wasn't going to sleep well. I had to go through the mental aspects of losing a child, and I just wanted to get there. So I asked the charge nurse to let me go. They had to escort me right to the of our vehicle, where my husband picked me up, and we came home. And on the way home, you anticipate, you know, it made me. It's the same route we took when we had our newborn baby in the car, except for it was pitch black at night, and just, you know, you're coming home empty-handed and having gone a two-day trauma experience of losing your child that you've really fought so hard to have. It was traumatic. And then my dad on the way home, he said that the hardest part for him was leaving me in the hospital and thinking that, you know, I could not be coming home if something went wrong. He wasn't there to help advocate for me. So that was a really hard experience for both of us to get through. And I spent the next 3 or 4 days just focusing on my healing. And I was able to open the non-invasive prenatal testing. that we were having a son. And so we and me wanted to name our son. And we did that. And this is still very fresh, I should say. I'm about 5 weeks from my DNC. So my hormone levels have gone down now to the normal range, and we're waiting for my cycle to start back so we can go again, which is a decision that we made together. We wanted to continue to try, but I will say that the community around loss and miscarriage is very familiar to the infertility community. And so we found that home again, with our Resolve support groups and with those around who know what it's specifically like to go through infertility and loss. These are clubs no one wants to be a part of, but I have found that, you know, being in them, there is an enormous support network. And this podcast has been a great balm for our soul again, as we've gone through this and as we continue to go through it.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Oh, thank you so much for sharing all of that. I mean, obviously I wanted to interject in between, but I was just like, no, she's explaining. Every time I want to interject, you explain what I was going to ask the question on. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. But oh my gosh, what a journey that you have been on. And for you and your husband to really make that decision to move forward with. I hope that the listeners really got that from this episode. You know, obviously they made a decision to move forward with donor sperm to conceive, you know, their children. They found community, they found a place of solace and healing, they continued therapy. And then on the other side of loss, as they're starting to talk about trying again, you know, go back through the IUI process, you know, I feel like there's a sense of grounding that you have. There's a different purpose that you have now as well, just from hearing your story. And I'm so honored that you gave us the platform here, you know, the opportunity here using Sisters in Loss platform to share the options, because I really enjoyed how you broke down options. And then obviously having that family support through partner's family, because they knew the condition. So they were extremely supportive of the entire process. I guess the other question I would have is just how do you share this information with friends? Is this something public, or is it still very private on how you all have navigated fertility?
So I would say that we choose who we share it with, you know, and we have shared it with friends close we hadn't before. And that changes, you know, based off of our comfort level. It also changes because, you know, some of our friends disclose to us that they have been through infertility. Most recently, we had a couple of us who have experienced 8 miscarriages. And imagine that, I had no idea that had been the case and they were going through fertility treatment. So, you know, in those instances, we share our child's donor conceived status because we feel comfortable doing so. But publicly, we haven't shared this with the large, I will say, again, out of respect for our child's privacy. Now, later on down the road, if our child decides they want to disclose this about themselves, we are 100% supportive of them. One thing we know for sure is we are their parent. We have been raising them from birth to adult, so we are their parents. And that's that love never changes. And that's something we always like to remind our child. We always say we love them so much and we're so grateful for them.
Other thing that I love about your story is that even in your loss, that you honored your son, that you found out, you know, obviously through the genetic testing that you did, but you named him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we always forget for babies that we physically may not be able to hold in our hands, that we don't always give them names. So for you all to know to do that and just to honor your son in that manner by actually naming him together as a couple, I think that just, you know, obviously kind of rounds it out, but also gives you a name to call him when you want to bring up his memory and keep living his memory out loud as you move forward with becoming parents again. So thank you for sharing that as a part of your story. And just overall, I mean, obviously, you know, before we, you know, talked about just how we wanted to make sure that your story came out and you were able to be open and transparent and vulnerable. And I think that it has definitely been displayed, and our listeners will definitely benefit to know that they can have some pregnancies, even with male factor infertility, and even through loss, you know, there is still a resilience and determination and hope that you can still hold on to as you navigate that journey. So with all of that being said, I would love to wrap up with just you leaving us some encouraging words. Obviously, I feel like you've dropped nuggets throughout the whole time, but you know, this is still fresh and new for you. I mean, I'm sure you're still grieving, you're still healing, you know, physically, mentally, but for a lot of our listeners who, I mean, we're still in a pandemic as well. So, you know, we still, I feel like we're all still experiencing some form of collective trauma or collective grief with this pandemic, coupled with the losses that a lot of us had this year, this past year. So encouraging words can you leave us as we all are just navigating this journey together?
I would just say that, you know, the love that you have with you and your partner and in your community and your family, like, it's a love that gets you through these hard times. I receive so much, so many welcoming words, so many comforting words, even folks that just sent me cards in the mail. And I didn't realize how touched I would become and how touching people have reacted to our loss has been, even though we are in the midst of a pandemic. So in many ways, that comes together even more so now. So I would just say to folks, like, you're not alone. The miscarriage and loss is extremely common in our society. And just know that there are resources out there for you. Don't be afraid to access them. Again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we felt like, you know, we had this like stamp on us that we were having infertility issues, and that it was like this invisible stamp that we felt everybody could see, but it was there, right? So those resources help you feel that you're not alone. And I think that that is the most important aspect to keep in mind when going through infertility and loss in this community. It's a large community. Access it. Talk to people who, because those are the folks that really can relate to your journey. And don't be afraid to get to reach out to somebody and say, I need some help. And I say specifically for women of color and people of color, like, go to those resources. Find the balm that you need, because unfortunately, like, you know, there's even more of a stigma within the community with some of these issues. So that community's out there, but don't be afraid. Listen to this podcast, reach out to the Facebook group. There are many places out there that can help you, but don't be afraid of them. Lean into them.
Lean into them. Well, that's such a great way to end this episode. Thank you so much for your story in its entirety. I know that it's going to be to another listener, another couple that's out there. Thank you for listening to today's episode. For show notes, go to sistersinloss.com. To stay connected with us and join the Sisters in Loss community and receive my weekly newsletter, please go to sistersinloss.com/newsletter. That is sistersinloss.com/newsletter. Please rate and review this episode, and I will talk to you next week.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.